Good morning, Lake Burien. It's good to be together again, and I'm super excited about our conversation that we're going to have this morning. You see on the screen here two friends of Lake Burien, Miguel Escobar and Cote Sorens. Many of you know Cote and Miguel. They are members here at Lake Burien. They live in South Park, and I'm sure we're going to hear from the both of them about the great work that is happening down there. But it's our hope and desire here at Lake Burien that we partner together with the work that is happening there. Cote and her husband have been there for a number of years already, sort of building trust and connection with their community. And I'm super excited that, you know, for what is happening there and the development actually of a local church, neighborhood church. So all of that is some context for this conversation, and also to get to know Cote and Miguel a little bit better. So thank you again to the both of you for joining us. Today's passage that we're talking from and speaking together from is Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46. When the Son of Man comes in glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. The king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" And he will reply, "I tell you the truth. Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me." And then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison and you did not look after me." And they will also answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you?" And he will reply, "I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you didn't do for me." And they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. That was a lot. That was a long passage. It was long. And I just, maybe we can start with, you know, as you all have been looking at that passage, and even as I've been reading it, what stands out to you? Or maybe even like one of the questions that Tally asked a couple of weeks ago, you know, how has that passage been taught to you, been preached to you? Say a little bit about, you know, both how you've heard that, and maybe even today, you know, what stands out to you?
I think one of the things that stands out to me immediately is that it makes righteousness, or like this distinction between God's right hand and left hand, not about like rightness, you know, like thinking correctly. And that would have been, I'm surprised that it wasn't more shocking when I was younger, because I think being right about things was probably a priority, maybe the biggest priority when I was younger. And maybe this just went along with that, being right about, like, doing the right things, you know, clothing people who weren't clothed and feeding people who were hungry and that kind of thing. But I think it's also interesting that I don't really remember that the passage about meeting people's needs is not a very memorable passage in my child from my childhood.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that, just a little bit, so you were saying that kind of your, the frame that you remember was, are you talking about in terms of your kind of religious or upbringing as it relates to church, was more about being right? Is that what you're
saying? thinking correctly about God, about people, and having a kind of like intellectual set of priorities.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think this is a kind of challenge to that, this passage. But and I think that's probably why it doesn't stand out to me in my memory of my theological upbringing. It's just kind of there. Mm-hmm.
Cote,
that's
how about
interesting. Yes, because this passage to me falls squarely into the huge debate that I grew up within. In my context, because I grew up in Chile, as many of you know, and when I was a child, the Catholic Church was the official religion in Chile. And then in the 90s, and I was part of the transition, Los Evangelicos, the Protestant Church, and it's very different than the Evangelical Church here, but the Protestant Church sort of made a very, very, very successful missionary takeover. And I was part of the transition. And in the context of Latin America, the thing that the Catholics and the Evangelicos fight about is the very issue of salvation, whether it is by works or by faith. Mm. So this passage is interesting. It's I've never been able to read it outside that question. Of salvation, and it's, and as somebody who grew up in both traditions, I can't help to read it with many layers, to say the least. Uh-huh. Yes.
So your reading of this passage is about taken to the very end, is like those of you are, you all are in because you did these things. Is this what you're saying? And you all are not because you didn't do these things.
Right. So if you read it within the Catholic tradition in Chile, at least, this is a passage that speaks of that salvation by works. Mm-hmm. But if you adhere to the salvation by grace, salvation by faith, then it gets a lot more complicated around how to read it. So I have wrestled with this passage a lot, actually. And I can expand more on that if you want, but
yeah, please do.
Of course, I stayed within the Protestant tradition, and I do believe salvation is by grace and by faith. But I do resonate with what Miguel is saying about the American Protestant tradition is very much we conveniently choose what would you take literally. We take very literally Romans 3:23. Around, like, if you say with your mouth, if you declare with your mouth that Jesus is the Lord, you're safe. Great. And then we forget about everything else. In this passage, in a way, adds more texture in the sense of, I do believe, I do rest in the notion that Jesus made salvation cosmically possible. But then, but the texture of what does it mean to, what are the effects of that belief in life should show themselves as love for neighbor.
Yes.
So I love the notion that Lina in a previous conversation brought about, that this parable or this story might be in the context of how Jesus asking, how do you know who I am?
You know, it kind of harkens back a little bit to, the God's love and the demonstration of God's love is practical and tangible in our lives. in our relationships with our neighbor, right? So, Cote, I mean, Miguel, how would you sort of riff a little bit off of what Cote's saying in terms of this, you know, the cosmic salvation and, you know, what is being suggested here?
Riff on cosmic salvation.
Sorry, I used that word.
Yeah, I really like the language of almost like the anticipation of Jesus, right? Like, how do we anticipate Jesus in our lives?
Very good.
Uh-huh. How is it possible that people are, like, where are they expecting to actually find Jesus, right? So they call Jesus Lord in this passage where it's like, Lord, when did I miss you? Uh-huh. How was I supposed to know it? That's how it sounds to me, you know? And so there is this expectation that that Jesus would have been found, that Jesus would have been located. It's almost like a surprise, right?
Yes.
Like the people are surprised at Jesus' expectation that they would have known somehow. And I also think it's interesting, the idea of the nations being gathered, that this is not, I don't think, just believers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which means that either just them or all people are being kind of expected to do the same. And it doesn't seem like there's a special designation for believers who missed it, right? And there's also no special designation for non-believers who got it. Mm-hmm. It's all the same group expected to do the same thing. And it seems like some of them were successful, and we don't know which of them were believers or if all of them were believers, right? We just know that some people met Jesus.
Saw Jesus, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And fed Jesus, you know, the least of these, whatever. However that came about, they knew enough, you know? And I think that's where it would be a challenge to salvation and expectation of Jesus in my life from my theological upbringing. Where, yeah, the expectation is that you just keep knowing stuff. Mm-hmm. And the little bit you know might be actually enough.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, I was thinking about, that's so good. The little bit that you know might be enough. If the little bit that you know is a corrective on how you see, you know, where are you, Lord? I think when Cote was talking about the Romans 3 passage, you know, confess with your mouth and believe with your heart that Jesus is Lord and you will be saved, right? I'm with you, Cote. I didn't, and this is funny. Not.
This is funny,
but not really. Like, I was trying to remember when this passage became a part of how I understand my faith as a person that follows Christ. It was not part of the curriculum, discipleship curriculum for, you know, Romans 3, absolutely. You know, for sure. I need to make sure that I check that box, confess with your mouth and believe with your heart. And I better make sure that, you know, that I'm getting other people to check the box too.
Well, to me at least, this passage, you know, draws us back to the commandment of love God and love your neighbor. Mm-hmm. So if we take that very literally again, it's like, oh, who's my neighbor? and we start looking around our neighborhood, we're going to see that there are many people who are hungry, are thirsty, who are immigrants, which is the primary way I read stranger, and people who are, and people who are in prison or sick. You don't need to look very far if you pay attention to your neighbor to find people who need to be visited and fed, especially now.
Yes, right. So can I, Kotev, I think a lot of people, I get asked this question a lot, how do I do that? I mean, I don't know if you get asked that question a lot, how do I get to know my neighbor? And I thank you for sort of helping us. And if you wanted to say a little bit more about this, I think it would be very helpful. You kind of threw it in there, but I want to hear more. You said the primary way that you read the word here, stranger, is immigrant. Could you take just a little bit of time to talk about that, maybe in the context of your community?
Yes. Yeah. So, well, I think I would this to the evangelical immigration table. They started talking about the notion of a stranger, and then Old Testament was the word ger, G-H-E-R, appears 92 times. And it is the immigrant. We're supposed to treat them like our family, like one of us. And South Park is largely an immigrant neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We have so many first generation immigrants living here. So when I read this passage, I immediately go into, well, those are my neighbors, and all the challenges that it presents to you, particularly not only immigrants. I'm an immigrant too, but I'm incredibly privileged. I think I'm talking to a particular kind of immigrant, which are those who haven't had access to obtain papers of any kind, and for whom life is incredibly challenging. Mm-hmm. Those people are in my neighborhood, alongside many others.
And I know it's different, right? It's different when you, applying the lens of this passage, the corrective, right? That's Jesus, right? That is Jesus in your community.
Yes.
Right.
And absolutely it is, especially in this neighborhood, because, South Park, as many in a congregation that like be familiar with the history of South Park, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it was incredibly dangerous to walk down the street because of gang activity. And there was this group of moms, immigrant moms, who started organizing on behalf of their children and their youth. Mm-hmm. And it's because of them that this neighborhood is safer, mm-hmm, and more livable. Mm-hmm. Yet, because they're undocumented, they don't have access to purchase a home here. Mm-hmm. They have devoted everything to this community, and they don't have the same access that other people have. Mm-hmm. But that has never that I've seen discouraged them for continuing loving their neighbor, much in the way that Jesus would, unconditionally, right, and with all the stamina they have. Mm-hmm. So as a faith community, our role has been to recognize because Jesus tells us to do that, see them, yes, as Jesus, mm-hmm, and get behind them the best we can, mm-hmm, with our resources, connections, in friendship, in mutual relationship. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was a great gift when we moved to the neighborhood to recognize that, which I love what Jesus said about having eyes to see, like Jesus, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit will give you eyes to see, to pay who to pay attention to, who's walking like Jesus in the neighborhood, and submit yourself to their leadership. Mm. And that was incredibly impactful to be able to do. And the way we did it wasn't anything too flashy. We just committed to to discern what was the Holy Spirit up to here, and look around and ask Jesus to have eyes to see and pay attention.
Yes.
Pay attention to the people who were very faithfully mm-hmm. working on behalf of everybody else without any recognition. And yeah. I think there is a little bit of a shout out to those people who are doing kingdom work without knowing it in this passage.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because when did we see you? Like we were, you know, amongst the sheep, you know. When they didn't know that they were serving Jesus, you know.
Isn't that good news, though? To me, that's a really good news, because it makes me sort of pause and go, I might get in trouble and be fired from my job for this one. But it does. The passage actually creates space for this idea that unless we get really good at seeing the work, quote unquote, and seeing all the things that are happening where people are being cared for, taken care of, then we miss Jesus, right? But you know, I think Miguel, you said that both folks were surprised themselves. Mm-hmm. Oh, is that what we were doing? Right? I have a good friend who had been in, you know, community work for a very long time, and always knew that the work that she was doing was God's work, but the church didn't recognize it as God's work.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that happens a lot, is that we, unless it happens from and within, you know, this thing, it doesn't count. And yet Jesus is saying, don't do that, because you don't know. Right. Miguel, what do you think? What are you thinking?
I'm thinking about a reference back to chapter 10 in Matthew, verse 40. It's very, very similar. It says, whoever receives you receives me, and whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. Mm. And we don't use the word whoever very often in the church, right? We use like Christians or believers or like things like that. And that whoever is huge. It means that we can actually follow the lead of people who are doing good things and call it ministry, you know, call it the gospel. And I think that is something that I see happening a lot in South Park. I'm much newer to the neighborhood, mm-hmm. but some of the people who I know are doing good work, they're sheep, you know, I mean, they're definitely not goats. Mm-hmm. And there's something that we need to pay attention to there, you know.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Go ahead, Cote, what were you going to say?
Because we have a lot of those. And I do feel that if our church as a body were to go back to the tradition of being radically welcoming, which is how the church is referred to in the times of Acts. Apparently what they were known for, being so hospitable, you know. I feel that if we were to take that tradition seriously, all of these people who are doing God's work probably would much better identify with the message of hope and liberation of the gospel that we're stewards of.
It's so sacred to me what we're talking about. In the highest 100%. Sort of way. We're going to wrap up a little bit, but I would love for folks to know, just specifically, could you describe a little bit of what's happening? And because for many people, I mean, South Park is just right over here, and I don't know how many people know, as they're, we've heard this a lot. People always say, you know, I used to drive through South Park to get to Georgetown or to get to Beacon Hill or whatever, but I would love for folks to hear sort of from the both of you who live there, you know, what are ways that we can support the work that's happening that y'all are doing in kind of the neighborhood there?
I think if we were to summarize a lot of what we're doing, it has to do with just being present, And presence is actually really difficult. I know it sounds really like flippant and really just kind of like, oh yeah, we're just being present, but it's really hard.
Why is it hard, Miguel?
It's hard. I mean, like if I say like, hey, get to know this neighborhood over here, like that's, where do you start? I mean, that question that you asked sounds like it's just like, oh, here's a little tip, you know, on how to do that. It's actually just really hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about too, like a lot of our social, like the social problems of my generation are often like, yeah, meeting people, making friends, you know, and I don't think that that's new, right? That's just kind of something that's been going on. And we pretend like it's like, oh, that's just, well, you'll get there, you know, just focus on your career. And yeah. if the theology of presence is actually what's needed, right? If actually knowing who's hungry, knowing who's thirsty is where ministry is, where you find Jesus.
Yes.
Then pursuit of Jesus means being present with those people enough to know who it is, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we know that it's difficult. I don't know. It's
Well, it's really countercultural. It's very countercultural. We, quote my husband, we we are trained to think about place. Like, you know, we're a mobile, online society, mm-hmm. and it's such a rudimentary thing to think about. Whoa, what is the actual physical environment where I'm at, and committing to be present there. Everything mm-hmm. is pulling you out away from that. Constantly, so yeah, that's echoing what Miguel is saying. It's not easy to be present. You have to actually make a lot of adjustments in your life to be present in a place. But it's so worth it, especially if I can just send a note of encouragement to everybody. This year has been incredibly difficult for so many people. Yet, there's been a consistent comment that outsiders have made when they come to visit us at the coffee shop, etc. Like you guys look like your spirits look high, like you're high up in spirits. And it's been the gift of being surrounded by neighbors in mutual aid and mutual help. It's been so inspiring. It's been people say like, hey, I get really bummed out with the national context, and then I come, but I see what we're doing as a neighborhood for each other, and it just fills me with hope. And I think we're all who have been engaged in this together in the neighborhood, around food access, around helping with childcare, around prevention of addictions. It's been so filled with hope and such a counter story, counter narrative to everything we've seen in the news. That's the kind of thing that makes me believe that we are up to something when we are present in a neighborhood.
I think some of what we've said today when I was younger might have really destabilized me. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Because there is control in knowing that you are where Jesus is. Or that you know what Jesus looks like, or where Jesus is going to show up. And then if that's kind of challenged, then, you know, it's not very comfy because you lose control. But there, I think it's actually just really beautiful, right? And I really like the way that, so Matthew 10 removes the dichotomy, you know, because I just want to picture myself as a sheep. But if it's whoever, that's actually a good thing, right? It doesn't mean you're out. It doesn't mean you don't get to be a part of it. It means you are, and it means a lot of other people are too. And that's great. That's a beautiful thing. I think it's part of God's design. I mean, the people who are literally feeding people here, they are whoever's, you know, in South Park. And it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's inspiring.
Yeah. Hopefully that encourages all of us to, you know, to kind of walk out your door and have our eyes, you know, adjusted, our vision adjusted, and being creative in our prayer and asking, you know, God, show me, you know, where are you? How can I see you? Even in the places that are the most unlikely, which is, this is nothing new for what we've been talking about at Lake Burien. We're just continuing to press into the surprise of some of these things and, you know, being okay. It's all right to be a little bit destabilized. It really is. And I think we all would agree that this season right now, COVID, that has made it even, you know, we can't pretend that we're going to kind of control our way out of this. So I think we just kind of trust God and roll with it and know that we're all going to be okay. So Coach and Miguel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This morning. Thanks.